Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the New Books Network podcast. I am your hostess with the mostest, Lee Pierce, and I am the host for the channel in language and the channel in media and communications. And I'm very excited today to welcome Justin Eckstein and Donovan Conley, who are the editors of a brand new book hot off the presses entitled Cookery, Food Rhetorics and Social Production, which came out just last month from the University of Alabama Press. I'm excited to welcome the authors, discuss all of the awesome things discussed in this book. And also for those of you who have been participating in a little pandemic cookery yourself, this should be a book that really resonates at the current moment in time. So let's welcome everyone. Donovan, Justin, are you okay? And our first name's all right.
Yes and yes. Hi, Lee.
All right. Hi. Oh, it's so great to talk to both of you. And you're over on the Pacific Coast. So we are like occupying two different temporalities right now, which is always kind of weird to me.
Yeah, no, different time zones, different geography.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The Justin, whole deal.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. First name's great. And yes.
Great. Well, I would love to hear from either one of you, whoever wants to go first. Let us know more about yourself, what your deal is, and then maybe a little bit about how the book came to be and what you love most about cookery.
Sure. I'll start. I'm Donovan Conley, and I've been a professor of rhetoric and cultural studies at UNLV for a bit. I got there in 2004. Actually, Justin was one of my master's advisees.
Oh, no, he wasn't. That's adorable.
I know.
Do you want to let people know what UNLV is?
Oh, sorry. University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the Running Rebs. And yeah, so Justin was there getting his master's. We worked together on that project, which is a really cool analysis of the evolving nature of apologia coming out of sex scandals at the time. And then he went on to get his PhD and then he got a job. And we've been kind of doing conferences and co-authoring sort of ever since. And this book really came out of that collaborative, you know, kind of network that we've been developing with a few others where we would, you know, go to conferences and do a session on this or that, usually food related. And then the book just kind of emerged out of that collaboration.
Yeah.
That's so funny because Justin is like my food person at conferences. So when everyone's like, where should we eat? I'm like, I don't know. Let's look at Justin's in social media. see where to go.
There are worse things
he has his nose in it.
Well, Justin, do you want to introduce yourself too?
Yeah. So my name is Justin Eckstein. I am at Pacific Lutheran University. I've been there since 2013 and I am an assistant professor of communication and civic engagement. As Donovan alluded, I was one of Donovan's students. This started, I've always loved food. It is amazing and delicious. And it is true. You can always find me eating. My favorite part of going to conferences is the opportunity to eat at different restaurants in different cities all across the world.
We were pretty bummed about RSA getting canceled. We were getting ready to do a food panel in the food city. It was going to be perfect.
Oh, God.
Yes. And for the listeners who don't know, RSA is the Rhetoric Society of America conference, and it only happens once every 2 years. So it's a bummer. Obviously not like the greatest disappointment, but just it does suck. I totally agreed.
Yeah. And I'm in Tacoma, Washington. So.
Oh, okay.
Not too far from Portland, but yeah. Yeah, Donovan and I wrote this chapter in the Food Rhetorics book when I was, which was a book put out by Rutledge many years ago when I was in my PhD program on my work in farmers markets. So when I was getting my doctorate, I actually worked in a lot of farmers markets hustling spices.
That's awesome.
Straight from the spice farms.
Yeah, the spice farm. Exactly. And, you know, we took that interest. And then when I got to PLU, I met up with the amazing and wonderful Dr. Amy Young, who also happens to love food and wine. And she's one of the authors in the book as well. And she sort of hooked us up with this group of people that became this cadre that we would meet with at conferences that slowly emerged at first into a special form in communication critical cultural studies that Donovan also and Amy and I edited. And then we were able to put it together into this book.
Well, what an interesting evolution. That's very cool because there's sort of like a parallel. There's like almost like a contradiction between sort of the slow carefulness, which with this book emerged organically, and then some of the sort of top down problems with mass produced food and its rhetorical environment that you kind of point out in the book, which is sort of fun to know.
Hmm. Yeah, this is I'll just sort of add the last little piece maybe about the book, which is to give a like tip of the cap to Justin. So we did one session. I can't remember what year was it, dude? Was it 2015, 16, 17? I can't remember. But we did a panel at NCA on dirty rhetorics. That was the title of the panel. And we just thought that it went really, really well. You know, like that rare conference where it was just like everyone was really popping and the audience really popping. And it was just great. So we thought, let's try to capitalize on this. And the first thing we went after was the RSQ special issue, but that didn't happen. Mm. And I think we tried to shop it around a little bit, but special issues are tough. And Justin is tenacious, and he has his nose in all kinds of corners. And so he went and talked to Dan at Alabama and made the pitch, and Dan was interested. They were just starting to get interested in food stuff, so... I thank Justin for that.
Shout out to my boy Dan Waterman over at Alabama. We do a lot of Alabama books on the New Books Network, and he repeatedly comes up as like one of people's favorite editors. So thank you to him.
He's amazing.
Yeah, we love Dan.
Well, let's kick into the book. So you use the word cookery, which for rhetoric people is, we obviously know it's always this allusion to like Plato and the philosophers and using language is like a way to be a charlatan. But you, of course, do cool stuff with it in the book. And you've chosen to not only talk about cookery, but also sort of reclaim this concept of soiled, which is really neat. So do you want to talk a little bit about the opening and the framing and what the two of you sort of envision as the contributions of the book?
Sure. Yeah. So, like I said, the panel at NCA was called Dirty Rhetorics, and that was the running title or theme or conceit there for a while. And Dan, one of his first comments was like, well, we might want to think a little bit about dirty rhetorics, right? Because that kind of takes the mind in a certain direction. And so we were just bouncing ideas back around, Justin and I, back and forth. And for me, it was one of those shower moments where I was like literally having a shower and the word cookery popped in my brain. And I thought, wow, this could be a good way, because I was really interested in like grounding this new kind of exploration in food within the tradition, you know, sort of like to affix it into certain disciplinary conversations and tensions and so on. So it made some sense to go back to that original analogy for thinking about rhetoric as, you know, mereness, right? So going back into the Gorgias and thinking about the fact that Gorgias, or that Plato, was talking about rhetoric disparagingly by associating it with food. It's like, let's go back there and kind of like retell that story and start there. And so that for me is an important sort of conceit of the project, which is to take these wide-ranging explorations of food and drink and, you know, intoxication and pornography and strangeness, right? Very kind of broad cultural concerns, but also to attach them to some way of thinking about our own tradition and our own discipline and bringing forward some of those concepts and relevant questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a provocative intro. It was a very fun read, especially, I think, for a novice, because I'm always reading these books with an eye towards someone who doesn't know much. And I thought that this was a great way to introduce people to like a very long conversation about whether rhetoric is, you know, exactly what you said, like an like adulteration or not, that most of us have read over hundreds of thousands of words and you managed to do in a couple of pages. So it's really well done.
Okay, cool. Thanks. I wanted to kind of take the opportunity to think a bit more broadly and materially about rhetoric. That's another theme, right? Is the materiality of rhetoric is probably where we all began, like with our interest in food and interest in like the ways that we were talking about food, is to be thinking about bodies, thinking about affects, thinking about structures. Mm-hmm. And mediation is obviously an important part of that, but we were really trying to think about like, you know, physicality and the way things move and take shape.
Yeah. Justin, do you want to contribute to that before maybe we talk in terms of like a specific example we could talk to you about? Because I always get nervous when we head into territory like materiality, because I feel the listener is just going to be like, what is that? You know?
Right.
So what I would say is what I like so much about food and why I think it's so interesting is it's just such a great object to get at these questions. And, you know, when I talk to my ordinary friends, normies or people that aren't academic, they always love, like one of the first people that I gave a copy of this book to is my buddy in the restaurant industry who just loved it and read it, you know, because food sits between culture and nature, that binary, in such interesting ways that you can bring up and point out and demonstrate how it illustrates the social. So, for example, you might go to the grocery store and you look around and you see oranges, and those seem like natural things, right? Because they're oranges, right? They look like they're from nature. But then when you take a second and take a step back, you recognize that they're the product of this mass industrialized system that's actually a technology and that every bit of it is designed. Or you look at a banana and you recognize that that banana is a clone and that banana is a product of arguably the largest living organism in the world, right? There was some debate about it and what exactly that means and how you can start thinking about those questions with a rhetorical lens. And what does that mean for rhetoric as well when we start thinking about those issues as a question that we should be ready to ask or objects that we should be ready to include in our domain?
Very well explained. It's almost like you two have done this before.
I should also maybe add real quick that Justin wrote three glorious pages on the history of the industrial banana that did not make it into the introduction. So I'm glad he got a chance to talk about it.
Bananas today. Bananas.
It's true. It's plural, right?
Yeah. We had a split, but, you know.
Who knows? Maybe it's its own paper that you can eventually give to us. I love hearing about banana rhetorics. Yeah, well, the book does a great job. And so let's just to kind of wrap up the introduction. So you have this concept soiled and it's like the one. So other than cookery, it seems to be like the other big term that you want to bring up in the. So do you want to say anything about like what you're doing with that or how that's sort of like a framework for thinking about food as this thing that is both rhetorical and also sort of material?
Sure. I think that, we don't spend a ton of time sort of theorizing or conceptualizing that term, but it's an important refrain throughout the whole book. And I think Justin and Amy's chapter in particular really sort of illustrates that, right? I mean, the whole project in that chapter is to talk about how actual soil can become the site of an argument against industrial processes.
Well, let's jump there because I loved this chapter. And it is called the Terroir. Which looks like terroir, but in French it's terroir, and topoi of the low country. And I loved this because my father was a wine guy. Yeah. So we talked a lot about terroir, which I still can't pronounce because my French is terrible. So yeah. So, and this was a co-authored piece with Anna Marjorie Young, who isn't in the interview, but maybe Justin, you could tell us more about that. And what is topoi and what is terroir and how does that sort of do the work you want it to do rhetorically in this chapter?
Well, I could say a couple of things. One, it involved an amazing trip to South Carolina as well. So we got to eat at a bunch of Sean Brock's restaurants, which was incredible. But the idea is that the history of French winemaking actually goes all the way back to attempting to erect some sort of boundaries to distinguish French wine from the globalization of the wine trade that was happening, right? So what Sean Brock does is when we return to the original soil, he's starting to invent these disassociative argument schemes. So
Justin, will you real quick tell people who Sean Brock is?
I'm sorry. Sean Brock is a public chef intellectual. This is a term of art that Amy and I coined to describe chefs that are out in the public advocating what they believe is in the public good.
Yeah. So like who's the British Jamie Oliver? Is that that guy's name?
Yeah. Jamie Oliver.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure people know who that is. Continue. Sorry.
Yeah. And so one of the things that he advocates for is eating local. But what it means to be local means knowing where your food comes from, because food has complicated histories, right? In our current environment, when you go back again to the example of the grocery store, looking at the banana, you don't know where it comes from because much of our food is unplaced and unsourced, right? So by returning to the dirt, we're introducing all these terms of distinction, which enable us to recognize where it comes from. And that's where origins of terroir are. I'm probably mispronouncing. I speak zero.
I know. And of course, now that I'm thinking about it, now every time I pronounce it, it sounds stupid. But I really like the inclusion of this chapter, because I think one of the things like where rhetoric gets a bad rap just for a general public is that we only ever use rhetoric to describe terms that are exclusionary. So like, of course, when the French people decided to like make certain terms only mean French and everything else was just like derivative, that's when we notice rhetoric, but we only seem to notice it when it's a bad word. And so here, sort of like the double-edged sword that like all inclusion is exclusion and like rhetoric isn't some things, but it's everything, I thought was really well pronounced. And I always like that as a rhetoric advocate for like, no, it isn't just cookery in the bad sense. It's also the making and the creation and the production and the germination. And so it's all that stuff too.
Yeah. Right. And the term we came up with there was polyvalent production, right? Because the food system churns out so much, and a lot of it's terrible, but some of it's great. And, but the whole business of just kind of, you know, newness and creation and production, and lo and behold, rhetoric is also in that business of like generating appeals and creating arguments and messages and reaching bodies. So both food and body rhetoric are sort of reaching bodies in very interesting, similar ways. So I love that. Absolutely. I love Justin and Amy's chapter because they are doing exactly what I mentioned a bit ago about the kind of grounding, literally sort of grounding their analysis in this idea of topos and sort of taking a term that comes from the culinary world into and bringing it together with a term that goes all the way back to, you know, the ancients. And I think they do a really nice job of also making a really important argument about distinguishing a kind of a historical cuisine and an identity against this sort of homogenizing system. It's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Justin, do you want to say anything else about that?
Well, no, I think it's absolutely important that we start understanding the way that the flow of capital works in these globalizing agro-logistics, right? If part of the argument of cookery is that we understand how a food system operates to smooth space, right, over sovereign borders and markets, then recognizing ways that we can introduce striated space or differences amongst soil, I think that is a rhetorical project worth undertaking. And it's something that chefs can do by introducing it along the sense organ of taste. So I thought that was a really unique site of rhetorical production. And it was a lot of fun to write about and think about and drink.
Think about and drink about. And you also make this really cool sort of more specific argument, which I love, which is like, so Brock, Sean Brock, this public intellectual chef, writes this book, Heritage, which is his big cookbook. Mm-hmm. And you say that there's kind of this real irony about Heritage because it advocates for like eating local. And yet most of the people consuming the book could not consume it locally. And so the book itself calls for an action that could not be accomplished by most people who consume the book.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to say more about that, or is that pretty much it? Did I just summarize it?
it is in and of itself really fascinating, right? Because it's this idea that's saying, well, it's about buying into the ideal and the aesthetic and what constitutes the good life. Well, the good life is about eating local, even if you can't buy the particular ingredients or follow the recipes that Brock is suggesting, right? It's sort of like, have you heard of Slim Aarons?
No, is that another chef?
No, he's like a photographer. He took images of the good life for Town and Country in like the 50s.
Oh, okay.
Produce like these coffee table books, right, that you'll put out and you'll just look at these people living lives of luxury, and this defines the visual sort of imaginary for some of what the good life might be. Even though it might not ever be attainable or aspirational, it still provides, you know, a set of topoi for which we may aspire and, you know, arrange our sense of self in relationship to. I think of the cookbook as operating in that same sort of way. Even if we can't get those particular ingredients, he's giving a sort of aesthetic that we should orient ourselves towards eating local within 100 miles, what that might look like, getting vinegars from a particular site, what it means to pickle and jar, even if it's not that particular set of ingredients, what it means to cure, so on and so forth.
Yeah, very cool. Well, and this also sort of like this idea of like this aesthetic and the book not so much being like an actual literal formulation, but more of a an orientation toward food.
Yeah.
Makes me think of the food pornography chapter. So I don't know if anybody wants to say more about Justin's chapter before we move on.
I would just add quickly the sort of piggybacking on that last point. You know, there's a couple of chefs out in New York. I think they might be the Carbone guys, but these are Italian, Italian-American or Italian? I think they're Italian-American, but they really do prize Italian food. And, you know, as you may or may not know, there's not such thing as really as national Italian food. It's all hyper-regional. Right. And so their argument is like, if we're cooking in New York and we are, you know, grabbing whatever we can find in the upper borough area of whatever, and it happens to be, you know, local raspberries or whatever, like that's as Italian as it gets, right? And so their argument is like, even though we're not cooking sort of traditionally Italian meals or using traditional Italian ingredients, we're using what we have nearby. And that's sort of the spirit of Italian cooking. And I think that that's sort of the point that they were making in the chapter, right? Is like, you can't really do what he's celebrating in this book, but you can take the spirit of this this notion, right? Of like sort of reclaiming traditional practices and reclaiming a sense of kind of connectedness to your own region, your own sort of history. That's important, I think. That's worth sort of thinking about in your own context. Now, I'm living in Las Vegas, and so what does that mean here, right? It's like, cactus tacos and right. You know, critters tacos or something like this, but you know, what does it mean for you to do that where you are to the extent that you're able?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready to eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because, I mean, obviously, like, you have to read rhetorically to get, because I don't think I did an interview recently. I forget what they said, but it was like how there are how you have to be looking at the text with that in mind, or else it might seem like impossible. Or you pick up a book about local cooking, and if you take it literally, you immediately see the hypocrisy. But if you think about it as the spirit, like you said, right, thinking about these concepts of topoi, then suddenly it's like, oh, it's not meant to be. literally this recipe, but it's about showing you like a habitus of doing what you can with what's around you.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that sort of triangulation of food, history, and place. Right.
Yeah. Which is fun. This is my favorite kind of stuff. Like I never would have seen that in a, I mean, I'm pretty good at this, but I would have picked up this cookbook and probably not thought about it that way. So I think this chapter does what I love about rhetorical analysis, which is I see the artifact differently now, right? More materially, more sensory. Very cool chapter.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. All right, Justin, you want to say anything else? Do you just want to accept your praise quietly?
I like to accept my praise quietly.
I know you do.
And Amy, sure Amy is accepting it quietly as well. She is amazing.
Yes. Wherever Amy is, I appreciate your contributions, Amy. Sorry, I don't mean to. I tend to deal with what's right in front of me. I'm not a big thinker. So let's talk a little bit about Casey Kelly's chapter on food pornography, because I know we can't talk about all the chapters, but this one we kind of all agreed was one to highlight, and then we'll move on to Donovan's chapter.
Okay. Justin, you want to take it or you want me to take it?
After you, sir.
Sure. I just reread it this morning, I think. You know, we've edited these chapters so many times, but you often don't see the forest. You're just like, you know,
trimming
the branches. So it was fun to go back and see what he's up to there. And I think he gives a really astute analysis of how it is that desire moves from, you know, in between the screen and the boardrooms of these marketing corporations and our own sense of hunger and appetite in our own bodies, right? And so what he's up to in this chapter basically is arguing that corporate media, food media, has replaced or substituted our own, the domestic kind of cook, home cook's knowledge about cooking with just pure desire, or even like he would say maybe horniness for food, right? So horniness for food is the sort of the perpetual task of corporate food media, is to just keep the viewer, keep the body kind of, I think he says addled, great word, sort of addled with desire, ineffable desire, just wanting more, right? And so he gives us this really great sweep of analysis of like, you know, Instagram, and then he goes to like Food Network, and then he might remember a couple years back this YouTube show called Epic Mealtime. It was these Canadian guys who would just go way over the top with their consumption. And what he does is he kind of associates each of these different platforms and mediums with a certain kind of pornographic signature, let's say, right? So there's the amateur, then there's the, you know, the long storyline, and then there's the hardcore porn kind of idea, which is what these Mealtime guys are. And he's tracking the ways that corporate food media is able to kind of tap into bodily desires, like affect, right? Longings, actual kind of visceral longings in like patterned ways. And I love this idea of thinking about the relationship between a genre, you know, like a kind of narrative, and a sort of a patterned set of longings that are being called forth through these images. I think sort of conceptually it's very smart, but it's also just really powerful way of thinking about how it is that, you know, the food corporations have given us images in place of knowledge about how to actually cook.
Yeah. And I don't know about anybody else, but the description of the chef and the corn dog was so good. So if nobody minds, I actually highlighted it to read, because I was like, nothing is going to capture this better. So essentially he's talking about this best food found on a stick show. And so there's a chef, it's a woman, of course, recounting stories of her, I'm never going to be able to get through this without laughing, of her encounters with the corn dog served at Shake Shack in New York City. And this is, and I quote, "At the outset of her narrative, the camera gives spectators a series of brief close-up shots of the sumptuous phallic-shaped meal." Right. So it's like, and he doesn't really go into too much detail, but like you can imagine these like giant, long, phallic shaped corn dogs that she's eating, kind of like the chocolate covered bananas, which are always a joke whenever someone orders those from the ice cream store. But that you don't really get what you want, because you want that to become something it does, because then immediately it shoots back to her talking, it shoots back to food. And so it's sort of like you don't really get either thing, right? You don't really get a relationship to food in terms of cooking and production and growing. And you don't really get sex. You just get this never ending production of your want for both that just keeps you consuming, right? Just like you were saying. Yeah. But the corn dog thing was just perfect.
Yeah, and there's that kind of stuff like throughout the whole chapter. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's great. It's very clever. Yeah, so I loved this chapter. I thought it was and it was a cool contrast to sort of, I thought, the heritage chapter, which is much more, I think, reclamatory, and this one is much more critical of the way that, like you said, like Food Network especially has just turned food into a consumption object that just like really could drive one crazy. I mean, if you think about it.
What I really like about Casey's chapter is I think about on the meta critical level is the way uh-huh. you're able to weave in a lot of these newer critical tools with some of the older rhetorical tools.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So you take one of these sort of older rhetorical ideas of genre theory, and he's able to weave so seamlessly affect into it and make it into
right.
a comprehensible tool and show how you could use it in such an incisive fashion that I think it is really excellent as an exemplar of what good criticism looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I felt similarly about your chapter.
Aw, thanks.
Yeah, so congratulations all around. All right, so does anybody want to say anything else about that? And then I thought we'd move on to Donovan's More Than a Membrane.
Well, I guess come to think of it, these two chapters might pair up fairly nicely, because I was just thinking to myself, like Casey Kelly gives us a really nice, powerful analysis of the sort of deterministic relations between, you know, viewership and consumption coming from corporate food sites and so on. And I find myself wondering, all right, so what do we do? You know, like, where do we find ourselves now, and how do we kind of deal with this? And I guess that sort of tees up my chapter a little bit, which is the most kind of explicitly about the question of the political, right? And when I was writing mine, it was actually, I remember this pretty vividly. It was after the Trump election, the 2016 election. And I remember myself being kind of angry with the postmodern left. Rightly or wrongly, this is where I identified myself coming out of grad school, is like, you know, this idea of we need to get past reason and the rational and, you know, the tyranny of reason and so on. We need to embrace experimentalism and play and the irrational and the theatrical and so on. And along comes a presidential figure who is doing that, but for all the wrong reasons, essentially. Right. And so it's postmodernism gone wrong. And then I found myself frustrated with, like, oh crap, things can really twist in ways that, you know, we didn't expect, using our concepts, right. Our ideas about engagement.
Well, and you had people saying that, right. You had people coming out and being like, this is all postmodernism's fault on the blogs, right. Like, this is what you wanted and this is what you got. And it was like, oh damn. Well, if we'd known that, maybe we wouldn't have felt differently, but you never know. I mean,
postmodernism is always an easy, you know, whipping boy.
Yeah. Right. So, exactly.
So that was the impetus. And so that's where it got sort of, attached to these ideas of the social versus the political, or the distinctions between the social and the political. And I'd been very keen on this new venture called Local by Roy Choi and Daniel Patterson. Roy Choi, some people probably familiar, the food truck, the Kogi food truck guy, really important mm-hmm. voice and presence in the, and I think Justin would probably call him a public chef intellectual. He's got a great series out right now called Broken Bread, which I actually want to plug, because it's really important kind of food social justice type show. I have a grad student writing her project on that show. It's really great. So I was grappling with this sort of the distinctions between the social and the political, or this question of like, what I'm struggling with invisible influence, right? It's like how it is that these two chefs who are really, really smart when it comes to like what's good, what's bad, what's healthy, what's unhealthy, you know, what's sustainable and unsustainable. And they're basically taking all of that and cloaking it inside of this really sort of garbagey vessel, right? Which is fast food and cheap food. I was fascinated by this decision, right? It's like, why are you trying to sneak something good inside of something bad? And it was sort of like, well, we give up, you know, there's no point arguing. There's no point trying to convince people. Words, persuasion, arguments, information, these things no longer have any kind of force. And so we can't reason with people. We need to just inject the good straight into them, kind of idea. Right. And it seemed really both clever and sneaky and troubling. So that's sort of where the chapter, the essay took off is the importance of thinking about distinctions between this and that. And so, you know, in coming out of Casey's chapter, right, it's like this sort of ocean of affective desire that is generated through all of these pornographic images of food. My chapter then kind of responds by saying, all right, but what's, you know, how do we think about the limits of this experience, right? And how can we understand what is and what is not something that we want to call food or not food, right? And when you get into the research on the kind of the technology and the science and the processing of all this stuff, it's like, what's food anymore, right?
Right.
So to me, if you extend this thinking out, then where we end up in terms of like how to think about ecology politically, distinctions do matter, because otherwise it's just this big kind of ocean of stuff, right? So there's a little bit of frustration pushing that analysis, but I also think it's worth stating.
Yeah. Justin, did you want to say something? Because I just, in terms of grounding this for an audience that hasn't read the book, I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the bleeding veggie burger.
Oh, well,
as like an example. Justin, what did you want to say?
I was just saying the distinctions argument is sort of what we were making in the terroir, right? The claim, terroir and topoi, right? The need to make arguments to introduce differences is important. Otherwise,
right,
when things get homogenized, it's easy to lose place of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so easy then for like corporations to push an agenda that at some point that there's a quote, like people are neither fed nor fed well. I can't remember where it is. Sorry, I didn't underline it. It just kind of stuck with me. But right, that's like the desire for the corporate structure, right? That people consume, but they're neither fed nor fed well.
That might be in and around the kind of the cheap food. Raj Patel,
so.
Jason Moore wrote this really.
I think it's Raj Patel. Yeah.
Yeah. So they have this really cool book on cheapness, basically.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so you talk about this bleeding in terms of like just stuffing the good inside the bad.
Mm-hmm.
You have this like idea of this bleeding veggie burger, which I had not thought about. I mean, we've heard a lot recently, especially about like the Beyond burgers being really like popular, but I didn't know about like wanting to make these vegetables look like they were bleeding to kind of trick people, like you said, to eating the good in the bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So do you want to talk a little bit about that just in terms of the audience so they understand what you mean by that concept?
You bet. This was starting to emerge a little bit as I was writing. So this is already a couple years ago, and it was already at that time sort of full force development. And I was keeping a close eye on any news item I could find about the bleeding veggie burger, right? The whole idea being we are not asking – this is not like who's the intended audience. It's not vegans. It's not vegetarians. It's in fact meat eaters who cannot, again, they can't argue themselves out of eating these things, hamburgers, whatever. So let's stop asking them to be persuaded and let's just give them the thing that they want, except it's not the thing that they want. It's right. A better thing, right? It's this magical plant-based patty. Down to the, I talk about it as this sort of digital copy. In fact, as I was reading it this morning, I was thinking about like 4K, 8K, like what's the level of definition on televisions now? It's like, that's where we're going with hamburger patties made out of plants. It's like the high definition, you know, plant-based burger. So I was just so fascinated by the fact that they were trying to make these things bleed to replicate in a kind of digital fashion that experience of eating a regular hamburger, right? The lengths that they were going to, the science, the technology, and I hate to say it, but also like the carbon footprint that goes into creating one of these patties versus a meat patty, it ends up being a pretty tough call, like which one's actually, you know, obviously we don't want to be eating animals the level we are, right? But these things are not like a magic solution by any means.
All right.
Yeah. And you make a really great argument on page 121 as you're kind of wrapping up the chapter and essentially, cause like exactly like back to the question, like why does it matter, you know, carbon footprint? Yeah. But why does it matter for how we think about politics that these Beyond burgers are saturating our food sensorium? Right. And so you say these various forms of social production from local to bleeding vegetables to plant-based foie gras to crypto economics miss the prerogative of the political, which is to enact critical judgment by drawing qualitative distinctions and I can never say this word, estetizing grievances as bids on alternative futures.
Yes.
I can't talk.
Thank you for reading that.
It's a great sentence. It's so good, I can't read it loud. And I practiced it. I practiced it even more embarrassingly.
Yeah, that's the sort of the big hurrah moment at the end there. So that was, that was the big sort of like, okay, so what matters here? That's like cards on the table, right? So we got to have the courage to be able to say, look, this is not crap food. This is, in fact, good food. And you should want it because it's good and not crappy. But not, on occasion, go ahead and have the crappy, right? We all like the crappy, but let's not kid ourselves that like we're going to just keep eating the crappy and somehow magically everything's going to work out okay. So that's the idea.
Well, it made me think. So a long time ago, there was this video that I saw of Jamie Oliver, and he's another one of these. He's like kind of like an old school celebrity chef, and I can't find it anywhere anymore. But essentially what happens is he sits these kids down and he shows them like a raw chicken. And then he sticks the chicken in a blender and the kids are like, ew. And then he adds like the pink slime, you know, that they make like at McDonald's, and all the kids are like, ew. And then he takes this nasty wad of chicken gross and he turns it into these patties and he breads them and stuff. And the kids are like, ew. And then he deep fries them and pulls them out and serves it to them. And the kids are like, yay. Right. It's like showing them how the sausage is made had no impact on the outcome. And I think the video disappeared just because it was so disheartening. I don't think anybody wanted it around, but it really gets at what you're talking about here, which is like you people like the truth is not what's going to teach people the qualitative distinction necessary to prevent the imminent creep of crap pretending to be beneficial.
That's an interesting turn of phrase.
I'm trying here.
Yeah. I appreciate that you bring up.
My affect language is terrible, I will add, too. So trying to grapple with some of these concepts was harder for me than I thought it would be, which is good. I want to be challenged, so that's good.
Yeah, no, I love that you brought up that example. I vividly remember watching that series, Food Revolution, and that's when I first watched that scene. It just really shook me. And it really shaped my thinking about food and arguments and persuasion and frankly, rhetoric, right? And obviously, it's not a perfect kind of research project, but it tells you something pretty powerful, right. Which is, you know, I have a young son, 11-year-old, and I can argue with him all day about like how it's not that great to eat, you know, drink so much soda. And if there's a soda in front of him, he can't not drink it.
Right.
But literally, like the soda can is a stronger rhetorical agent than I am in that situation, right? And so that got me thinking a lot about, well, what is it that actually influences if it's not words and information? And here's the whole show, gang. Like, here's the disgusting carcass getting munched up in a blender and mixed in with all of these stabilizers and powders and blah, 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 blah. And they still want it, right? And it's like, what do you do, rhetorically speaking, in a situation where you've given everyone the information, you've made the arguments, you've shown them, you've demonstrated, that's Aristotle, right? Like demonstrate to someone and they should believe. But what about when none of that works? So I'm actually sympathetic with Roy Choi and Daniel Patterson going, you know what? We can't convince anyone. Let's just give it to them. Let's just sneak the carrots in their mac and cheese, essentially, and treat everyone like children.
Right. You call the conclusion delivering the goods, which I thought was very funny.
Exactly. Yeah. So
it's an interesting chapter. I mean, I really like that you're playing kind of like you're willing to suspend like traditional rules about what's right for the social and think about like, you know, there are real reasons why someone would choose the route of just sneaking the vegetables in, right?
Right. And it's a kind of defeatist moment, I think, which is like the parent who's just like, look, they're never going to eat it. I've got to just puree it and sneak it in. Exactly. There, right. And I feel like that we've all kind of given up in that point. It's like we can't even relate. We can't even talk to each other. We can't rely on information and we just want what we want. And that gets back to Casey Kelly's chapter, right? It's like the horniness for these products, these consumables is apparently so intense that, you know, showing people statistics or, you know, giving them really compelling arguments doesn't make much of a dent. So where are we then, rhetorically speaking, in terms of how to shape the future?
Yeah, it's a fabulous chapter. I mean, both of your chapters were just really good. The whole thing's good. You should be very proud. Be very proud of yourself for this wonderful book.
We think it's pretty good. It. Yeah, we're happy with the, you know, we got to work with some great folks and they brought good things to the table. So
yeah. Well, and then so Greg Greg Dickinson writes the afterword, and I don't know if you want to sum up any themes we haven't talked about yet, because obviously there's lots of this book we didn't touch on. So I don't know if there's anything pressing that you want to give a little bit of airtime to before we wrap up.
Well, I would. You know, there's two other chapters that we didn't really talk about.
Yeah, let's talk about them.
Rivers and Dickman, which I think is it's the most kind of theory driven, right? This is about sort of a post-structural theory of affect and mm-hmm. assemblage stuff. But they're really smart, and they organize it in terms of like the stages of making beer, right? And mm-hmm. they're likening rhetoric to intoxication. And so you can think about rhetoric's inventional phases through the phases of making beer. It's really, really not just clever, but actually smart and important way of thinking about influence. And it's funny because I had actually written a large chunk of the introduction. And then I reread what they had done. I was like, oh my goodness, am I stealing from them? Like, this whole business of influence is really important, ecologically speaking. So I appreciate their chapter. And then Jeff Rice's chapter is also really interesting. It's maybe the most sort of unique in the group, because he's offering
interesting.
Mm-hmm. He's offering a way of reading that's sort of going against a lot of typical kind of reading practices. And so he's trying to show readers how it is that what we think of as strange, what's strange to us, is just, you know, normal essentially to anyone else. And it's all about mm-hmm. kind of where we stand in our perception. And if you mm-hmm. actually look at accounts of eating things like dog or grasshopper or even penis and cannibalism and stuff, but like people mm-hmm. who engage in these cultures that engage in these kinds of consuming practices talk about them, write about them in the same way that we write about eating elk or fish or whatever, right? And so he's just trying to like demystify some of the cultural exoticism that surrounds mm-hmm. critical readings of otherness in terms of food practices, which I think is useful and important. You know, it's sort of a, what are the broad rhetorical structures, like the narrative conventions and, you know, that you might find in places where they eat things that you think are strange. And lo and behold, there's a lot of sort of shared rhetorical narrative devices, let's say, right? And so those are the chapters that round out the project.
Well, yeah, and I think Jeff Rice's chapter was really good too. And like the way these are structured makes a lot of sense, because it leads well into your chapter about the membrane and the qualitative distinctions among food, because of course, when you read the two chapters together, it suddenly seems so bizarre that you will say eating a cricket is gross, but eating a chicken nugget is not. Yeah. So they really draw each other into relief, I think, in good way. And again, this book is like not judgmental, which I really appreciated. So I think, you know, a lot of these food rhetoric books, you pick them up and they're really just a lot of like shitting on fast food. Mm. And I just keep thinking, like, you know, we all have we're raised to love that. I mean, it's like really hard not to at least have a little bit of affection for it. And this book I thought was very generous to its reader.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Yeah. And I felt that way all the way through. And one of those chapters was the rhetorically strange foods, was a nice way of saying like, hey, what you think is normal and strange are very much rhetorically constructed, but also no shame in what's happening. You just have to understand that it's persuasion all
right,
the way down.
Think about the kind of the context of consumption and it, you know, sure enough, it all makes sense. Just depends on, you know, where you are and where you stand and where you're perceiving from.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's lots of examples that can go either direction. And I even get at some of those in my chapter early on where I'm talking about like, you know, lobster is disgusting if you think about it. Right.
Well, there's like a stand up by Jim Gaffigan about how gross lobster is. It's really hilarious.
It boggles my mind that has become this, you know, expensive luxury. It's like, think about
right,
it.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
Do the history. It's not great.
Yeah. Justin, do you want to hop in? I feel like you've been quiet for a few minutes.
Yeah. No, I was just sort of reflecting on how we started with Soiled. And, you know, one of the controlling metaphors we offer in the introduction is how it's sort of like sedimented. How each chapter, and you can think about how the book adds up to these different sedimented layers. And when you think about wine, or, you know, I'm really into whiskeys, or how anything that's aged over time with different layers, how each one is an expression that contributes to the whole. And that's sort of how we were envisioning these different chapters adding up to a complex expression that makes up the book. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there are, you know, we were very intentional about the organization and arrangement of the different chapters and how they all work together to make a whole, right? That isn't one argument, but sort of creating a space to start thinking about what is polyvalent production. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, it's a great book. I was excited to have it on the New Books Network because I think this is really a book for people who just want to like read good stuff and don't, and which is who our readers are. They're not, you know, advanced grad students or advanced academics in rhetorical theory. They are people who want to like see the world differently using language, and that's exactly what this book does. So I think it's a great book for anyone interested in rhetoric, interested in food production, or just, you know, kind of like wanting to see the familiar in new ways. This book is like a great fit for all of those purposes. So thank you so much for the work that you did.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we're coming up on time. Is there anything else that you want to add? Maybe any other takeaways from the book that we missed, or anything you're doing with the project now that is kind of cool?
Well, you mentioned Greg Dickinson, and we were very pleased that he agreed to write us a little afterward, and he covered some ground that we didn't, the chapters themselves didn't go deep into. And I like the way that he kind of thematized and drew out sort of everydayness and sociality and bodies and thinking about sort of implications. So I was very happy to have our friend and colleague Greg be able to join in and have the kind of last say on the project. Beyond that, I think we've covered it pretty well. Justin, what about you?
Yeah, no, I'm just really grateful. I thought we worked with an amazing group of authors, and this would not be possible without their amazing work and their willingness to revise on our schedule and contribute their labor and ideas in the editing process all the way through. And the great, and Donovan was an amazing editor to work with as well. And thanks, Dan and the Alabama folk.
Yep. Shout out to Dan. Well, with that, we will wrap up. Thank you, everyone at home, for listening, whether you're in your car or walking around. We hope that you're doing well. Again, today, we were pleased to discuss the new book, Cookery, Food Rhetorics and Social Production, edited by Donovan Conley and Justin Eckstein, which you can pick up from the University of Alabama Press, hot off the presses 2020. And I always like to remind everyone that without university presses, the New Books Network probably would not be able to do the work that we do. Also, authors and editors like the ones represented in this volume would not get the care and attention to their ideas that they do get. So it's always wonderful to support books that come from university presses. And if you do not wish to pick up a copy of Cookery for yourself or a friend or a family member, you can also write to your local library through email or put in a request at the desk that they picked up a copy. Better yet, you can buy a hardcover copy from the press and donate it to your local library so that everyone in your community can actually benefit from these ideas, since obviously we don't all have the means to pick up the book ourselves. And with that, I will say goodbye. Thank you so much, Donovan and Justin, for being here today. Everyone, take care of yourselves and be safe.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.